Welcome to Positive Impact with Andrew Schultz.
Hey friends, welcome back to Positive Impact. Today, my guest, Randy Grimes. Randy is the author of the new book, Off Center, a memoir of addiction, recovery, and redemption in professional football. Randy is also a 10-year veteran of the NFL, an addiction interventionist, and founder of Professional Athletes in Recovery. Randy is a regular contributor to national media on the topics of addiction, recovery, and support for families affected by substance abuse. He has been featured in the New York Times, ESPN, CNN, Fox Sports, Fox News, MSNBC, and on the cover of Recovery Today magazine. Randy, it's an honor to have you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So let me ask you right off the bat, what is your intention today, and what do you want people listening to take away from our time together?
I want to continue to tear down the stigma that is associated with addiction or mental health issues. And I want everybody to know that it's okay to not be okay, but you've got to raise your hand and ask for help. There's hope and there's help out there, but you've got to raise your hand and ask for help. There's nothing to be ashamed of with this disease, and it is a disease, you know? So I want people to know that it's okay to not be okay.
And I want to acknowledge you, Randy, because I've read the book. For people listening, I recommend the book. So thank you for writing the book. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your work in a time in the world where it's needed now more than ever. And the thing that really stuck out of why I wanted to have you on the podcast, Randy, is, you know, of the 140 episodes we've done, I've never had a person who specializes in interventions on the podcast. And interventions are near and dear to my heart because we did an intervention for my father on Christmas morning in 2009. Literally, it was a Christmas miracle. And then my family did an intervention on me April 30th, 2015. And so the people who led those interventions, John Southworth, who has passed, I got to see up close and personal. I had a front row seat to the execution, the planning, and the groundwork that is needed for a successful intervention that I was a part of. And then I got to receive, I was on the receiving end of another intervention 6 years later. So I have a unique perspective as well, and an appreciation for what you do. And, you know, for people listening, you know, there's people sober, curious, people thriving in recovery, people who are struggling, families impacted by a loved one. So I really want to, people listening, I want them to understand, like, what the hell is an intervention, first and foremost? And then how do people know when an intervention is appropriate?
Yeah, and I think, first of all, I'll answer your second question first. You know, when is it appropriate? And, you know, the definition of addiction is anything that makes your life be unmanageable. So if you see somebody's life being unmanageable, then, you know, obviously you need to intervene in one way or the other. I mean, you ask somebody to go get the help that they need, and whether or not they respond to that good or bad, then that's when you decide, you know, whether or not you need an intervention. And, you know, the good thing about an intervention is that you get to, you know, you get to educate the family on the disease. You know, you get to teach them boundaries, which is something that they probably never had. Or if they did have them, they weren't able to keep them. And, you know, you find out who the weakest link is in that family group. And those are the ones that you really, you know, you spend most of the time focused on. But, you know, it's such a unique tool to save people's lives, because otherwise, you know, this is not going to turn out good. And, you know, we say all the time that you know, people have to hit their bottoms. Well, you know, a lot of times people don't recover from their bottoms. So I hate to say that term, because a lot of people don't come back from that. So, you know, an intervention is designed to meet somebody before they hit their bottom and offer them the opportunity to get well.
Mm. Yeah. And it, when you say life-saving tool, like I understand that and appreciate that, because, you know, for my father, you know, if we didn't do the intervention when we did, he wouldn't be with us. And he's been with us every day since then. And he's been sober ever since then. And it literally changed his life. And, you know, that Christmas morning, you know, it was one of the worst blizzards. It was Omaha, Nebraska, you know. And in your book, I love how you weave in the story of you doing the intervention, you and your wife, Lydia, for the family, how you weave in, you know, all the planning and all that goes into the intervention, talking to the family members, you know, rallying them, uniting them to support the addicted loved one. And, you know, for my father, it was Christmas morning, 2009 blizzard. We show up on his doorstep with the interventionist, John Southworth, who has since passed. And my dad answers the door, and he didn't know the guy in front of him. And he thought we were there to open presents. And so we walk in, we had our two letters, you know, the first letter, Dad, we love you. Mm-hmm. The second letter, Dad, we love you. If you don't go to treatment, we're not going to be in your life anymore.
Right.
And it was a 2-hour journey, the highs and the lows. And I thought there was no way in hell he was going to say yes. And by the grace of God, he said yes. We had a bag packed, his boarding pass printed. And here's the thing, Randy, that I know you'll appreciate, and for people listening, that blizzard in Omaha, Nebraska that day, Christmas morning, 2009, was so bad. His flight from Omaha to Palm Springs was one of the few flights that got out that day.
Wow.
And he gets to treatment, and his counselor, who's a friend of ours, Bob Newton, is his counselor, an ex Nebraska Cornhusker football player that my dad respected, and he was his counselor. And that divine intervention, like, I got to see it up close. And that's why it's so important that we're talking about the work that you do impacting so many other families, just like my family has been impacted.
Yeah. And unfortunately, people don't call me until things have really hit the fan. You know, either there's a DUI involved, or there's some legal issues involved, or health issues that are involved. And unfortunately, people, that's when families really like put an intervention on their radar. You know, that's when they really think, all right, we've got to go to extreme measures now to get our loved one the help that they need. And so that's when you're going in on people. You know, that's when I'm knocking on doors, like you were talking about coming in on your dad. You know, I've woken people up from dead sleep, you know, early in the morning. You do what you have to, because you have to know that they're there, that they're present in the facility that you're going to. And, you know, you've got to be prepared. But, you know, we go over that the night before. You know, I have a family meeting. We go over everything that could possibly happen. I prepare the family for anything, for any comment that might be made or any action that might be taken, you know, from saying that I can't go to treatment because I've got to take care of my dog, all the way to, you know, I've got to go outside and smoke. You know, everything that comes up during an intervention, I prepare the family for, and they're ready for it when it happens. So, you know, nothing is a surprise. Nothing is shocking to the family. And that's what you have to do. You have to prepare them for everything, because they've absolutely been to hell and back with that addict.
And the story that you reference in the book, you know, bringing the family members, you know, who have been negatively impacted and hurt by the loved one who is under the, in their disease, the sick person that they love. And I can't imagine how challenging that's got to be for bringing all those family members together to unite for one purpose, to help that one person who's burned a lot of the bridges of those loved ones.
Yeah, and that's what I was talking about, finding the weak link, because the addict will seek out the weakest link, and that's the one that they're going to prey on. And, you know, that's the one that's going to cause the most problems and destroy everything that you're trying to accomplish that day. So that's the one you really have to pay extra attention to, or maybe not even involve them at all, you know, maybe not let them be a part of it. So, you know, there's a lot of work that goes, there's a lot of pre-planning that goes into an intervention. I mean, you don't just show up one day and say, hey, go to treatment. You know, you've got to get the family ready and prepared for anything that might happen. And then you've got to be able to, you know, I always say that I'm not the one that gets them to say yes or no. I'm just the moderator. You know, I'm the one that keeps it from getting out of control, because we addicts, and I say we because I'm one of them, you know, we like to cause chaos, and we like to change the narrative to an argument. And then that way the focus is on the argument, and I don't let that ever get out of hand. I keep control of the room and what's going on, what everybody's saying. And, you know, that's your job as an interventionist, is to be the moderator and to keep everybody under control. You know, you don't want anything to get to an argument stage, because then it is out of control.
Yeah. And I can relate the preparation that the interventionist does. Like, for in my father's example, the night before, it was Christmas Eve. We met in a hotel room at the interventionist's hotel room, we flew him into town, and we did it. It was like, I love your references in the book. You know, you're a ex-football player. So it's the preparation. It's the meetings. It's laying the groundwork to make sure.
The game planning.
Game plan. To make sure it's a successful execution of the play when you get on the field. And so I remember one of my aunt at the time, who was really, her health was not good. And she ended up writing a letter that we read the morning of the intervention. But the night before, getting all the planning, who goes first, making sure we got both letters. What do we want to articulate and communicate to our loved one who is sick in that first letter? And if they say no to that first letter, if they're not willing to get help, how do we articulate it and put up those strong and healthy boundaries in the second letter? And I remember writing that letter, Randy, like how scared I was of telling my father, the strongest figure in my life, like, I'm telling him now, if you don't get help and get treatment and go to the treatment facility, I will not be in your life. And at that point in my life, Randy, I had not experienced so much fear as writing that second letter. And like, you talk about boundaries, but that's what's needed in that second letter to get the attention of our loved one who is sick.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because letters are so important. You know, I tell families, you know, you just like you said, you know, that's the Johnson model intervention. And, you know, you write a letter, and you start the letter off by de-escalating the client, you know, telling them how much you love them, how great they've been, you know, what a great brother or sister or father, mother, whatever they've been, you know. But I also encourage them to get brutally honest about how their addiction has affected your life. And, you know, people are pretty good about that. You know, they want to start in by attacking them, because that's how they've been affected and that's how they feel. But I tell them, you know, let's de-escalate things first. You know, let's start it off telling them how great they've been and what wonderful things that they've done. And then we'll go into that. But also the second letter, and this is after they continue to say, no, I'm not going to get help. I don't want to get help. You guys are overreacting. You know, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. All the stuff that we hear from addicts, you know, I tell people to prepare that second letter as a list of consequences, because the one thing that all addicts and alcoholics respond to is consequences. And we have to have consequences and boundaries, whatever you want to call them. That's what we have to have for these people. And as a family, we have to stick together. And that's where that weakest link comes in. You know, that's where we have to identify that weakest link and make sure that that person is educated and on board to do everything that the family's willing to do. So, There's a lot of planning. I plan where everybody sits. I plan where who's going to read their letters and when. You know, I go over the letters with them the night before and make sure that everything that they put in there is positive or and is helping, you know, produce the right answer. There's a lot of work that goes into that leading up until the intervention. But when we knock on that door, when we get them out of bed, when we do whatever we have to get in front of them, we get them on that couch, you know, sitting next to the right person. We know everything that's going to happen, how it's going to go down. And if it does happen, how we're going to respond to it. And everybody is prepared. And I think that's the mark of a great interventionist, somebody that prepares the family for everything that's going to happen. And believe me, there's a million things that can happen in an intervention, and you've got to be ready for all of them.
Well, in the book, you talk about, you don't go into too much detail, but you talk about a few things that have happened when you have done interventions, like getting a gun pulled on you, for example.
Yeah. I've had a gun pulled on me walking into an intervention with Coach Jackie Sherrill, of all people, and had a gun pulled on me. And, you know, you got to be prepared for that. And thank goodness he was with me, because he had a better relationship with the player than I did. And but, you know, those are the kind of things you have to worry about. Matter of fact, I asked that. When somebody asks me to do an intervention, I ask them if they have any guns in the house. And really, that's a two-part question. You know, first of all, I'm worried about them hurting themselves.
Yeah.
And second of all, I'm worried about them hurting somebody at the intervention. So, you know, I worry about that. We take precautions for that. We remove them if we have to. But we're prepared for all of that.
And also, I know you work closely with the treatment centers in Florida. And one of the things that is really important is, you know, the family dynamic and having the, you know, the family program to, you know, to educate and empower the loved ones, you know, of, you know, how to not enable, how to not enable the person in the disease, how to educate about the disease of addiction. And I remember participating in that family week, and we were sitting in a small group, and it was my turn to speak directly with my father. And he had been sober. This was February, 2010. He had been sober for about 8 weeks. And I remember, Randy, waking up that morning, that same amount of fear that I had while doing the intervention and writing that second letter, I had just as much fear knowing I was going to speak to my dad in a small group, him in front of me. I was going to tell him the impact and consequences of his drinking on my life for the first time. And I was, at that point, I was 33 years old, and the fear of addressing that family member in a safe environment, but that the family program and getting those same family members who were included in the intervention, continuing to educate them on the disease and how they can put up strong and healthy boundaries and learn how to protect themselves as well.
Yeah, and that's the most important part to me, is educating the families, because once you get them on board, once you educate them, then you've got it. You know, they know how to react. They know what to do, how to handle somebody, especially when they come home from treatment. You know, because I know as a former addict, somebody who was in recovery, somebody who was in treatment, you know, I thought I was going to go off to treatment and then I was going to come home and ride in like a knight on a white horse. And everything was going to be saved. They were going to be so proud of me, blah, blah, blah. When really, you know, I was the one that went off and got therapy, and they stayed at home and got no therapy other than, you know, whatever Celebrate Recovery they went to, or whatever therapist they maybe went to for an hour a week. And here I was off in treatment, getting all kinds of treatment all day long. So, you know, I had to prepare families for what's going to happen after the fact. And treatment centers that involve the family, that's the most important part to me. You know, that's the most appropriate facility, because they're the ones that are keeping the family up to date on what's going on while they're in treatment, preparing them for when they get home, and preparing them for how they should act after the loved one gets home. And that's the most important part, you know, to me. It's hey, you know what? You can go off to treatment and it's easy to stay sober those 30 days that you're in there. But when that door hits you in the rear end, hits you in the ass, you know, that's when it gets tough. And that's when you have to, you don't want to feel like, you know, I tell families all the time that you're not responsible for your loved one's recovery. But then again, you are responsible for the boundaries that you set. And you have to hold them accountable to that. And that's the most important part, is being accountable.
And Randy, that's a great point. Can you give some examples of for people listening, how they can, like an example of some boundaries that they can put in place and enforce with their loved one?
Well, I think it's important to know what they do on a daily basis. You know, short of just being completely irrational or whatever, you know, I think it's important that you know what somebody's doing on a daily basis, who they're seeing. Are they working? If they're not working, are they at home being productive in some way? You know, are they going to meetings? You know, without making them go to meetings, because, you know, like I said, you're not responsible for the recovery, but are they going to meetings? Do they have a sponsor? Are they being accountable to somebody every day? And, you know, for me, I went to several detoxes and came back home and just picked up the same old routine that I always did. But the last time that I went to treatment in 2009, you know, the difference was after that treatment, I stayed accountable every day, not only to my sponsor, but to the people that I was with in treatment. It was important that I let as many people know that I was going through what I was going through as I could. Mm-hmm. And I recovered out loud. And, you know, it was important that I stay accountable, and being the athlete that I am, I thrived on that accountability, you know, and I wanted to please people. I wanted to succeed. I wanted to be the best that I could at whatever I was doing. And that just happened to be recovery. And, you know, that's why September 22nd, 2009 was my last time.
And I love in the book, Randy, you thread in your own journey all the way from, you know, growing up to playing in the NFL, through your downward spiral of addiction. And the end is you literally crawling on your hands and knees into that treatment center that you just referenced. But like, for people listening, like, why did you get it then in 2009? Like, what clicked then before, and why did all the other times, because there was many times when your family tried to get you the help and support to get sober. Why in 2009, what changed?
You know, I don't know. I think it was the perfect storm. Was coming together in spring and summer of 2009. I had a very good friend that I played next to in Tampa Bay. His name was Tom McHale. He played right guard right next to me for many years. And, you know, he was doing the exact same thing I was doing. That was self-medicating his injuries he got while he played with the Bucks. And one morning he just didn't wake up. And that really got my attention. The fact that my daughter wouldn't let me come around my first grandchild because I wasn't fit to be around her new baby, that really got my attention. The fact that my wife left me because she couldn't sit by and watch me kill myself any longer, that got my attention. The fact that I was having seizures every day as a result of withdrawal from the benzodiazepines that I was on, not just opiates, but benzodiazepines. And that got my attention. The ambulance rides and then the fact that I was sleeping in a abandoned house with no utilities, that got my attention. You know, I can remember laying in the floor of that abandoned house and thinking, you know, I was a college All-American. I was a second round draft pick of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I was a NFL Man of the Year 1988 for the Bucs. I was all pro. And here I am sleeping in the floor of an abandoned house with no utilities, no car, no money, no job. And I can remember having those thoughts. And that was that was my rock bottom. And that's when I finally put my hand up and asked for help. And, you know, my wife was so tired of hearing the I'm sorry's or she's crazy, she's making a mountain out of a molehill and all that, you know, all that. She was so tired of that, but she was willing to make one more call for me. And that's when she called the NFL office in New York on Park Avenue. And that's how I got on an airplane that night, September 22nd, 2009.
And it's a great reminder, Randy, that addiction does not discriminate. Like what you just said, like all American, like that's the American dream. Like you got to play a game that you love in the NFL for 10 years, make really good money, be acknowledged for your work and your talents. And here you are living in an abandoned house. Like this addiction does not discriminate people from all walks of life that get afflicted by addiction. And it's a great reminder for people listening. And all in the book, like in reading the book, I'm going to be honest, Randy, I got really uncomfortable seeing all the things that happened, like your nine lives almost, of all the things that happened, you know, floating above your body in the ambulance, having the literal out of body experience, you know, the seizures, all the things that you put your family through. And at one point I almost felt myself judging. And then I remembered, whoa, he's not a bad person trying to get good. He's a sick person trying to get well, just like I was in my downward spiral of my addiction in 2012, 13, and 14, and all the people that I hurt. And it was interesting for me in the emotions that I felt reading through your book, reading through your story and your journey.
Well, and I always say addiction is the great equalizer. You know, it brings us all to the same place, whether, you know, Park Avenue to Park Bench, what they say, you know. And, you know, hopefully it describes the insanity of this disease, you know, and how it brings us all to the same place, you know, and hopefully that's treatment. But it's also promised that, you know, it's going to bring us either to jail or hospital bed or to death, you know, and those three things are possible. I see it every day. Unfortunately, I've buried many, many friends as a result of this disease, and I'll probably bury many, many more. But hopefully, you know, as long as I keep recovering out loud and telling as many people as I can about my story, then, you know, it'll offer people more hope and an opportunity to raise their hand and ask for help, because you don't have to live like this. You know, you can survive this. You can get over this. And you can at least maintain it every day and stay sober.
I like to say not just survive, but thrive.
Thrive. That's all right.
And I think it's so appropriate, Randy, to have you on today because, you know, over the last 2.5, 3 years with COVID, you know, the isolation and the disconnection and the loneliness, like that's the real epidemic. And so I've been to more funerals and celebrations of life the last 3 years than my first 4 years of recovery. And so the self-medication, the mental health challenges, the suicidal ideation, the drugs, the alcohol, pornography. And so it's so appropriate that we're having this conversation now, especially every time we open the news, the 24-hour news cycle, there's another ex-athlete, ex-child star, ex-pop star, celebrity dying way too young.
Leading cause of death for people 18 to 45 is overdose, you know? And right now it's an epidemic proportion. We're losing an entire generation of people right before our eyes, you know, and we can't stop it. You know, so the more that we educate people, the more that we, like I said, recover out loud, then the easier it is to put up your hand and ask for help. But, you know, I've buried so many people lately. I can remember being the captain of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Okay. For eight of the 10 years that I was out there, I was the captain of the Bucks. So I would go out at midfield and do the coin toss before every game. And standing out there at the middle of that field and looking around at what 80, 90, 100,000 people looks like. And we used to sell out every week. I mean, we weren't a great team, but it was a great place to come and drink beer and take your shirt off and watch football. Okay. Tampa Stadium was. And I can remember looking at what that many people looks like. And, you know, that's only a fraction of how many people die every year as a result of this disease. Of overdoses. And, you know, we have got to do something. You know, we talk about opiates all the time. We talk about fentanyl and everything that's going on. What we don't talk about is all the deaths that are related to alcoholism or prescription medication or methamphetamines and all the different things that are out there. There's so many people dying every year as a result of the substances that they're using. And we're a country that, you know, we self-medicate everything. You know, doctors throw prescriptions at everything. We as Americans automatically just self-medicate our feelings away, where we numb up and we don't want to feel. And, you know, that's what we have to tell people, that there's hope and help from, you know, but because things, like I said, when we started this thing, life does get unmanageable. And it gets chaotic. And I know with me, I couldn't stop the chaos until I raised my hand and asked for help.
Absolutely. And I know for me, like how much I can relate with you, your story, the book. Like I remember I would be sitting outside of CVS waiting to get my Adderall prescription filled. And like there would be a 7-day lag. And I was doctor shopping. I had two different doctors, you know, giving me a dose of Adderall that was the highest dose of any dose they gave. They would tell me, Andrew, this is the highest dose we give. And I had two different doctors, and I still wouldn't have enough to get me through a month. And I remember there would be a 7-day lag. I would be out of my meds that I was abusing a lot. And I didn't have access to them. And I would stay in my room and just take sleeping pills. And then I would go to that CVS on that 7th day and wait outside. And the craving and the feeling of my life is unmanageable. I can only manage my life with that new prescription in that CVS store. And I'm going to be waiting in this parking lot. Like, I don't wish that upon anybody, that pain and suffering. And that just unmanageability. And thank God my family ended up doing an intervention in 2015. And Randy, I'm going to admit, if my dad wouldn't have said yes to going to treatment in 2009, there's no way I would have said yes in 2015. And his courage to say yes and change the generational dynamic of our family inspired me to say yes 6 years later. And today, my dad and I talk almost every day on FaceTime. And we say, I love you. And we talk about things that we'd never talked about before, because we're both sober men, available, not numbing out. And every day since 2009, Randy, has been an absolute gift. Because my biggest fear in life was given the eulogy at my dad's funeral with the regret of not doing more to help save his life.
Wow. And that's the miracle of recovery. Hey, who did your intervention?
Do you remember? Joe Wagner and David Mallow.
Out of where? Where were they out?
Petty Ford.
Okay.
Rancho Mirage. Okay. Where Bob Newton is.
Yeah, yeah. And I know John Southworth. You know, I know everything that he's about and everything that he accomplished. So that's awesome that he was involved in your dad's. But I think it's important who you choose to do the intervention. You know, I don't think that just anybody connects with just anybody. And I know it's hard to pick that person, but you just kind of have to have a gut feeling when you talk to them and before you commit to somebody. you know, just kind of pick their brain and figure out where they're from, what their journey's been, and, you know, how successful have they been. And I think that's real important. And I think you obviously you picked a couple of very good ones.
And I got to experience both ends, you know, as the supporting family member who's organizing the groundwork and planning for the intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And then 6 years later on the receiving yeah. end.
Walking into that room full of people, full of strangers. And,
gosh.
Yeah, yeah. And you knew right away what it was. Right?
Oh yeah, because I knew better than anybody because I was the one in the other chair.
What was your first reaction? To go back to your room or what?
I was trying to come up with any excuse possible of how I could get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I had no money. I had I got evicted from my apartment. I was living in a hotel room that my mom came into town in San Diego in La Costa. I was staying in her hotel room because I had nowhere else to sleep because I had just been evicted. I had no money in my account. And I remember the two guys who did the intervention, you know, they pulled me aside away from my family. And we sat on the back of a pickup truck. We walked outside and the guy handed me his.
Why did you go outside? Were you refusing to go, or do you need to smoke, or what?
Both.
Okay. Okay.
And Joe pulled me aside. Joe Wagner, who's still a dear friend today, we keep in touch. And he said, "Let's go outside. Let's sit on the back of my truck." And it wasn't a cigarette; it was a vape. He handed me his vape, and I was vaping with him. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, and here's what was different this time.
Right? 1 o'clock. What time did y'all start?
It started at 11.
Oh, yeah.
I know it was a nightmare, but it was one alcoholic and addict talking to another. And he talked to me, Randy, man to man. And he shared his story. He said, "Andrew, I was in your shoes. Same as you 10 years ago. This is where I was. And this is where I'm at now. These are the things that I've done to change my life around." And he talked to me man to man, not talked down to me, not better than, same level. And we just connected in that relatability away from family, just me and him talking. And I had that gift of desperation, Randy. And there was just something about him. And you just said it. Find somebody who you have a good connection and rapport with. My family picked a good one because I could relate to Joe. And David, who was there to support him. And I said, yes. We got in his truck. It was me and my English bulldog. We laid down in the back of his truck, drove 2 hours from San Diego to Rancho Mirage. I remember he was listening to country music. I was sleeping in his back seat. And I knew my life was never going to be the same. And I was full. I had these emotions of fear, anxiety, relief, because the gig was finally up. And there was a part of me, Randy, that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I had this peace that I had the willingness to listen to live in a new way, to take in direction because my way wasn't working.
Was there also a piece of pride for you that you made your family proud? Because that's the most important thing to us, that we make our, you know, we want to please people.
And absolutely. Yeah,
we want to get our lives back and we want to get things back on track, but we also want to make our families proud.
100%, especially because my dad, who we, and I know in the book, you talk about your special relationship with your dad. And so for me, my dad was always, he was at every game, every practice. He was my coach. He was my greatest teacher. And he and I had a dynamic relationship. I wanted to make him proud. He said, yes, he got sober. How dare I not? Absolutely. There was a sense of pride in my relationship with my dad. Like I didn't imagine it would be what it is now. We love each other. We say, I love you. We're closer now, Randy, than we've ever been. And it's only possible because we both did an intervention helping support each other, and the love of family. And you write about it in the book, There's no greater force in the world than the love of family.
Right. And that's what saved my life. You know, the fact that they didn't give up on me, the fact that they developed some healthy, strong boundaries that got my attention, but they never gave up on me, you know, and that made all the difference in the world. And, you know, I wrote the book to be a platform to heal my family. You know, that was the whole intention behind the book, was to give my children an opportunity to share their experience, to give my wife, my mom, my brother, my sister, you know, everybody had a platform in the book. And, you know, I didn't really care if it sold a copy or not. I just wanted it to serve as a healing tool for my family. And, you know, it accomplished that plus some. And I'm so grateful for, I'm grateful that I had the fortitude and the desire to do that and include them, because man, that was awesome for my family.
Yeah. And in the book, like the healing afterwards, how you end the book, like the best part of this whole conversation is this, in my opinion, is addiction is a family disease, and so is recovery.
Exactly. That's the best way to put it right there.
And so I really want to acknowledge your wife, Lydia, as well.
She's the hero of my story for sure. You know, she doesn't get enough credit, but she's definitely the hero of my story. Without her, I wouldn't be here right now.
I actually, it's divine that you just said that, because in my notes to prepare, I said, special acknowledgement to Lydia, the real hero.
Yeah.
And to all our family members who helped support us and loved us and never gave up on us.
Right. You're right. You're right. And that's so important, you know, and I encourage families not to be that one that does give up. And so many times I hear of families that have stepped away. They just couldn't take it anymore. You know, they've completely abandoned their loved one out there. When there's ways to do it in a healthy way, you know, a way to do it to where we get that loved one's attention, and we make those boundaries mean something.
Beautiful. So, Randy, I appreciate you, man. I acknowledge you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for writing the book. I know there's people listening in 95 countries. They're going to be curious. They're going to have questions. How do they contact you to take the next step?
You can get in touch with me. If you can't find me, you're not looking very hard. I'm on all the social medias, but you can find me at Twitter and Instagram and everywhere else at SoberCenter60. You can find me at my website, which is proathletesinrecovery.org, randygrimespeaks.com, or go to my book website, which is offcenterthebook.com. And you can find me. And I'm always here to help people. I'm available. And I just want people to know that there's hope and help out there.
I appreciate you, Randy. And I just read the book. I got a lot of notes, a lot of great takeaways, a great tool for people listening to start the process. If you're interested in intervention, if you want to learn more about what goes into an intervention, if you want more support for you or your loved one who is battling addiction, I'll put the contact information for Randy in the show notes. And Randy, thank you so much for all that you do. Again, thanks for your service. Thanks for sharing your story. Thanks for the message. And I know people listening, our intention before we started, my intention before we started was to amplify your story and work that you do to educate, empower, inspire, and give hope.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. And interventions work. You're living proof that they do.
It's absolutely. Thanks, man.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you again next week. Until then, lots of love. I hope you all enjoyed listening to my conversation with Randy as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you or a loved one wants more information on interventions, I highly recommend Randy. His contact information is in the show notes, where Randy focuses on getting people into treatment. My focus as a recovery coach and transformational life coach is after treatment and taking their first step in recovery outside the treatment center. I work with people from all walks of life early in recovery. As a certified transformational life coach, I specialize in behavior change. And considering my own journey with addiction and the last 7.5 years in recovery, my mess has now become my message. And my test has become my greatest testimony. And my rock bottom, my darkest hour and greatest challenge is now my greatest asset, my brightest light and superpower to inspire hope for others. So if you or someone you know is in early recovery, looking for more guidance and support and direction and accountability, please reach out to me to schedule a 30-minute connection call. And together we'll uncover what's getting in the way, discover the negative impact and consequences those behaviors are having, and discarding those old ways of being to create new behaviors and habits and actions. I'm here to help you reach your full potential. I'm here to help support you to create maximum success, significance, and fulfillment. And I truly believe the best is yet to come for all of us. My mission is to empower others to take radical responsibility and create new possibilities in all areas of their life. And I'm here to be your coach. Please send me a message at Instagram, Positive Impact Andrew, or my website, theandrewschultz.com. Send me a message. Let's connect. Jump on a call. This is my mission, my life's work, my purpose. Thank you for listening. Thank you for spreading the message, sharing these episodes with friends and family and loved ones. We're now in 95 countries throughout the world, and it's thanks to all of you listening. We'll keep the positive momentum going next week. Until then, lots of love.